But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Commissioner!
Very urban.
We never change, we
never change, this is Jay every day.
We never change, we
never change, this is Jay.
We never change, we
never change, this is Jay every day.
Hey, welcome to another Verbal Shenanigans episode podcast, a little special event today. Actually joined by my old Italian buddy here, Dominic Bagnato. How's it going, Dom?
Going well. It's good to talk to you.
Yeah, I know. It's been a real long time. The reason I brought Dom on here is, well, one, because I'm always looking for guests, and two, Dom has a film coming out, or a film he's been working on, I guess I should say, for quite a while.
Yep.
And we're going to get into that for in a minute, but I've known Dom for a long time now, probably freshman year of high school, I'd assume, so that's,
yeah.
That's, I don't know, 14 years, something like that.
Yeah.
Me and Dom, we played a lot of soccer together, did a lot of hanging out, talking about shitty horror movies, and, you know, hanging out with his very Italian family, I must say. In fact, his dad was my coach for quite a long time. Every spring, every non-high school season, his dad was my coach. Let me tell you, this guy is a ball of intensity. You never knew if he was yelling at you, like, in a bad way, or he's just yelling how great the play was.
But, yeah, he's very enthusiastic.
He was just constantly yelling, which was, you know, which kind of fired you up in a way too, but in other ways you were just like, oh, that's just him yelling. Like, I'll never forget, like, you, your brothers, Chris and Dan, he'd be yelling and just be like, shut up.
That's more my younger brothers, yeah, for sure. But
yeah, you were more like the go with the flow kind of player out there. Although you were dirty as hell sometimes too, but
Yeah, for sure. Me and my brother Dan were both for it, but I feel like he would always get called for it, so I took pride in that.
Dan, you were like a sneaky dirty. You had the like Italian mom dirty, like under the table dirty, where like you would walk away, like kids like thriving on the ground in pain.
Or not even walk away, but you know, you go out of your way to help the guy up after you've just like totally taken out his legs.
And
but
blasted his Achilles heel.
Yeah, but you know, you're not gonna get the card if you do that. If you take the guy out and spit on him, you're getting a yellow or a red.
And so, Dan would be the guy like 10 feet away and slide like slide 30 feet and take a guy out and be like, what? What I do?
Exactly. He'd get up and throw his arms in the air. What? Are you kidding me? Yeah. And then throw it out of the game.
Yeah. And so, Chris was pretty cool-headed for the most part.
Well, he's you know, usually up front scoring.
Yeah, he's a little dainty forward. Dan and Dom both defensive midfield, things like that. So.
Well, you were always playing the center of D right there, and
I always,
you know,
had problems,
pretty much throwing people on the ground too. So it's not like it was only us.
No, I fully embraced that part of my game. It was always like, you know, I'm not the fastest guy out there, but if they're gonna get by me, they're gonna earn it. Like you know, like old New York Knicks basketball.
Yeah,
if you're going in the paint, you're getting hit
for sure.
And you know, coaching nowadays, it's like ridiculous. I try to, you know, tell the kids, try to tell them that nicely without saying, like, take the kid out. But I'm like, you're just letting him go past you. Like, throw your shoulder into him. Like, don't punch him. Don't push him where you're going to get a card. Just, you know.
How young are the kids you're coaching?
Freshmen, so they don't know anything.
Well, yeah, but they should be able to understand a professional foul, you know, like, hey, I might get a yellow card, but I'm going to stop a goal. It might be
Exactly, or at least give them a free kick. And you know, freshmen in soccer can't take free kicks, you know, like
not at all.
One out of 20 is going in.
If not that, even, not even one.
You know, they're blasting them over the net or right into the wall, and it, you know, saves a goal. But like preaching team defense is so hard with kids that age. They just don't care. It's all about, you know, trying their FIFA moves that they that they know. They're holding the R2 button. But you know, they're all want, you know. preseason happens and it's like, okay, you know, you try to get an idea of what you got. How many kids are defenders? You know, the one fat kid raises his hand. Okay. How many kids are midfield? Two skinny little guys raise their hand. The one kid who can't speak English just raises his hand. And yeah. Then it's like forwards. It's all of them. It's never a goalkeeper. It's always they're just forwards. So I'm like, look, half the time I play, you know, one dedicated forward. Sometimes I play two. But I'm saying most of you are going to be defenders and midfielders, and mm-hmm. you know. But
I like two. I like playing when people play with two if they can. But yeah, sometimes.
I like two. It really depends on like how you fill out the squad. Like last year, I literally had like all fat rec kids that never played soccer, and all the talented kids got taken up. We mm-hmm. won no games.
That's rough.
The average score was 5-0. That's all I remember. 5-0. And that 5 was basically the coach telling him to stop.
Well, that's the one thing about, like, I don't know if we used to ever play this when you were on my dad's team, but maybe when we were younger, we were actually one of the few teams that actually played 3-4-3, and we'd have three forwards.
Yeah, that's tough. That's really tough, especially when you have no D. You got to have that three.
Yeah, you got to have three good defenders, and you got to have basically one of those four defenders playing, like that's what I used to play, very defensive. So, you know, you'd have four in the midfield, but you'd have me back there, so...
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the three flat and then, like, the two stoppers in the front. So, like, five, but they're playing defensive mid in the middle, like, just clogging yeah. the middle up. Huge
gotta,
fan of that.
Just got to have people who know what they're doing, though, because otherwise you just get people in the other person's way, two people playing the same position, yeah. and then just losing out totally.
I always like to combine, like, a ball winner, like a kid who's good in the air, and, like, a kid who can carry the ball, like, up yeah. the field without, you know, dumping it off as soon as he gets it. And that's, like, the hardest thing to tell the kids is slow the ball down. Like, someone's got to carry the ball, let the rest of the team catch up.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and they're still just long balling it, or trying to go over the top, over the top, over yeah. the top.
It's just that, like, panic. You need that guy who's, like, assured on the ball and can actually. But
I remember when we played, we were a big-time long ball team, like, in high school anyway. Like,
well, a lot
trying to bomb it up to Brinkman and Ahmed and Chris.
Well, we were when we were, you know, I feel like in our high school teams, it was very much like the bruiser. We didn't play the beautiful game.
No, we were.
We were bruisers, and then we.
Senior year, you know, we had a couple, you know, sophomores and juniors who were also the same kind of way. Like, I'm thinking of, like, Matty Garofalo, and they were all, we had a lot of fouls, man.
Yeah.
And Leo, that kid would throw guys on the ground left and right, too.
Well, Colonia kind of had a reputation from that for me before us, though. Like, these aren't going to be the best guys, but they're going to have some heart, and they're going to make give you a tough time. So
I would take that team any day over the kids who think they're just, you know, super skilled, and then they play a team that's physical, and then they shut down instantly.
I mean, I don't know if I would take it over the other team, but it's what we had, so we may do, you know. I'd rather
have kids with heart any day.
I'd rather have kids with heart, but you can have kids with heart who also can, like, make a pass, you know. That would be the ideal.
Yeah. All right, so that's just a little bit of how I know Dom. Dom, you've always been, since the day I met you probably, you said you always wanted to go into film. I don't remember you ever straying from that, pretty much ever.
Yeah.
You know, early on, I remember you were very big into, like, horror films, correct?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so yeah, before I knew you, actually, right around middle school was when we started, you know, familiar story, making your own films on VHS tapes and everything. And I think we started with horror movies just because they're, like, the ones you can do on cheap and can be horrible, and they're supposed to be that way. But.
Yeah, yeah. But you were, like, big into the Halloween, from what I remember, the series Halloween.
Yeah, I mean, well, the original Halloween, I would still say, is the best slasher horror film.
I'd have to agree. I always liked Jason, but not the first, like, in that 3 and 4 range where he actually started, like, being, yeah. like, a killer, and it wasn't his mom or him in, like, a potato sack.
Yeah, those. I mean, the Friday the 13th movies, definitely something to be said for them, but not just a maybe a notch below the Halloween movie for me.
I would agree. And then, like every other horror series, they faded out into absurdity.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's like anything else. The people behind it changed, and the name went on, and you know, it's hard to say what you're actually having allegiance to if, like, all the people who are making it behind, but you have the same name, so.
Right.
You know.
So, you know, when you were in high school, were you writing a lot at all, or were you just kind of messing around with the camera more? Like, were you actually, like, sitting down and trying to hammer out a script or anything like that?
It was mostly messing around with the camera. Honestly, like, I don't know if you remember, but you were probably in some of this stuff. It was mostly, like, not wanting to do high school assignments and being like, you know what? But we were, like, smart enough kids where we would be like, we're not going to just not write this paper, but what we're going to do is we're going to write a skit and make a video and hand this in and, you know, take it or like it, you know?
Yeah, I was always into the video. Actually, I went to school, you know, basically for almost more the TV side of it and worked a little bit. And then now I'm like the lowly, like, wedding videographer. I do that on the side for money pretty much, but love to get back into it. It's just, I chose teaching for the more, I guess, stable job. I guess I kind of sold out, but. Working in the local TV station, it's just a great experience. You know, we weren't filming anything great, but, you know, the guy, they were hands off. They let you, you know, I got a lot of opportunities to shoot things on aircraft carriers and bands live and learning how to live shoot concerts and things like that. So a lot of things I would never get experience for quite a few years going into like a bigger TV station or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be, you know, rolling cable for the first 5 years, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
But
that's cool, though.
Yeah, it was cool. I wish I kept on it a little bit more, but you know, I'm finding a lot of other avenues. I'm enjoying things like this and going into the comedy.
Yeah,
the comedy again.
I heard you starting the stand up again. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's you know what? It's the hardest thing I've ever done in my entire life, and I love every second of it. Even the failure is so addicting in a way. Like I failed. Like a perfect example, Monday night I went, it was a bar in Clifton, like rough older comedians, a lot of like dirty kind of comedians, like middle age. And I can tell as soon as I got there, it was going to be, you know, rough going. A lot of people just kind of there sitting at the bar and I just ate it. I got probably like two laughs, but it's like, you know, it's almost so upsetting that you just like want to go home and work on the same jokes and figure out what's wrong and how you deliver and why you were so stiff or why one night you felt good and another night you felt like nervous. Like,
right.
There's a difference between like nervous energy and like just like absolutely nervous. Like, holy shit, I'm going to bomb. Mm-hmm. And I'm still obviously so green at it. It's like, you know, just little things.
Yeah.
You know, getting a laugh or two is that's like the addiction of comedy. But it's definitely, you know, playing in bands for years, multiple different bands, you could hide behind, you know, the mistakes you make with the drummer and another guitar player and a vocalist and hide with other people and take it like a team. You know, if you sucked, you all sucked. But being alone and trying to manipulate people to laugh at you, hardest thing I've ever done. But
yeah, that's
definitely enjoyable.
It's like one of those, like they say, if it's not scaring you, it's not worth doing. So, but yeah, that must be hard. Like, I mean, I'm not a performer in any way, but like stand up is not, it's all you. There's nothing to hide behind it, but it's also like, you don't have to ask anybody to do it. Like, you can just go yourself. You're not waiting for money. You're not waiting for anybody to, you know, like if you're an actor, you have to wait for a role, et cetera. Yeah. But like, you know, you don't have to wait for a band of people. You just go out and just do it, which is just, it's pretty cool.
And it's also one of the few things I find where it's still absolute freedom of speech. Like, whatever the fuck I want to say, I can say in most places, you know, like, will everybody like it? Of course not. But that's not really what it's for either. So,
right.
But anyway, so you get into, you're messing around with the cameras in high school, doing skits, like, you know, we all did. Where'd it go from there?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I did try to write a little bit, maybe my senior year, but it was literally like handwritten on like loose leaf in a binder at the time. And like, you know, I'm sure that if I went
pizza box.
Yeah. Just scribbled in blood on a pizza box. But, like, you know, I'm sure that if I went back and read that, I would be depressed for months. So I didn't really write much. But then I applied to NYU's film school, and I think I used probably one of those things that we shot together.
Do you remember what it was? I'm having a hard time remembering specific things. That's the thing.
You know, I went back recently and kind of to digitize some, because we used to shoot those things on, imagine this, it was a VHS recorder, it was a camera, that a shoulder camera, the camcorder that took full size VHS tapes. Yeah, that was the medium.
My dad had one of those too.
Yeah, it forever. Was crazy, and it was
so shaky too. Like, there's no like stabilizing mode at all.
Well,
like,
it's well, I mean, that thing was so big, actually, and actually did rest on your shoulder, that it was a lot less shaky than a lot of, like, handheld stuff. But it was – because we didn't have any editing software, it was, like, the only editing was literally, like, I would hook that up as a – you would hook the camera up in, like, a VCR mode to another VCR and put in blank VHS in the other VCR and literally have to do, like, press play and record on the other tape until you had an edit, which was ridiculous.
Oh, my God. That's definitely bringing me back. Like, I remember doing things for school and trying to editing, and there'd be, like, random, you know, stuff on the video from a long time ago. Like, something I recorded would pop up for a half a second because I missed the spot.
Yeah, because you, like, you press stop instead of pause, so there's, like, an extra half a second, which is random.
There's a clip of Rocky popping in real quick.
Exactly. Or, like, in my case, old Italian soccer games that I taped over. Or
Juventus from, like, 1994.
Exactly. You have, like, boxes in my garage of, like, entire World Cups that are just taped on VHS. Oh, like, three games to a tape and just, like wherever. You
probably order them on a nice, like, DVD set.
Seriously.
Do you remember anything that we filmed?
I mean, yeah, but none of it is good or worth, you know, or worth mentioning, especially to, you know, people listening would have no idea. So
if you ever find anything that's really bad, send it to me and I'll throw it on the website.
That's so embarrassing. I mean, I actually made for, I think it was Christmas, I made a DVD for Scott, actually, Scott Boyko, not Scott Brennan,
right.
That was, like, all, because I used to do a lot of stuff with him, too, so as, like, a joke, I made, like, a full DVD with, like, him on the cover, and, like, actually, you know what's in that, what I put on that, which I have, which I will send you, is the talent show footage of Linus.
Oh, my God, you have that?
I have that, yeah.
The Drummond version or the non-Drummond version?
Well, it was the Colonia High School talent show. Drummond was there.
Oh, yeah, we did two. I think we did one with Drummond and one post-Drummond days.
Well, I think I only went to that one talent show because that's
probably enough.
It was, yeah. I mean, I was so anti-school that, like, going to any extracurricular activity kind of pained me. I don't think I could go to more than one.
Yeah. So you apply to NYU. That's where we left off.
Yeah, so I went to NYU. I got my degree in film and television, and then you graduate, and, you know, it's a whole other topic, which is how much it costs to go to college now.
Starving artist.
Yeah, the fact that the starving artist doesn't really exist anymore. It's either people who were rich to begin with who can afford for their parents to pay for college and pay for them after college as they pursue their stuff, or, you know, you have to get a job immediately just to cover, you know, you get 6 months and then you have to pay him back.
And then it's chaos.
Yeah. And it's, you know, NYU is like $40,000 a year. So it's more now, but,
NYU film school, your, like, average class, is it like a whole lot of working on projects outside of the class, or is it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's kind of built into, like, they tell you right away when you get there, like, you can't have any extracurricular, you can't really do sports, you can't have, it's like, for example, one of your classes might be 2 days a week, but 9 to 6 p.m., and then that's the class, but then you're expected to do projects in your off hours, so then you have, like, usually you have a crew of, like, 4 or 5 people, and each of you have to make something, like, every week or two. And so you're constantly crewing on other people's stuff, which is great because you get a lot of experience.
People to help out.
Yeah, I mean, you get to meet the people who you're probably going to be working. Like, this movie I just made, I'd say 90% of the people, well, 80% of the people I worked with, I met at NYU. And, you know, you make the film with the people that you know. So that's one of the big, big, big pluses of film school, is that you get to meet people who are interested in doing what you're doing and, like, you know, are at the same place as you. So you just do it for the passion of it, basically.
Right. So let's get into the film. I'm guessing you probably shot some shorts before this, right? You don't really – not too many people go straight to full length.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So NYU, it's like every year there's some version. So, like, your freshman year, you basically just – you do, like, sound collage. Like, you do, like, radio shows, essentially, all audio. And then you do basically stories using still pictures.
Right.
And then sophomore year, I mean, it may have changed now, but sophomore year, you're doing like documentary / TV. Mm-hmm. So if you do like short documentaries, I actually made a short documentary called Wet and Slow, which was about our,
It's not a porn. It's not a porn.
No, it's not a porn, but it is about our indoor soccer team, which our team name was Wet and Slow, because my older brother named us and created.
Is that wasn't the one we were playing on in Rahway, was it?
It's one of the ones in Rahway, but it was probably before you were on the team. This was like 2003 or something, I want to say.
Awesome.
So you can actually watch that on my website if you want. It's like 10 minutes long. It's actually kind of funny. Well, it will be for you because you know the people.
Right.
Then you do like some TV studio stuff where you're learning how to like live cut, 3-camera standard stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Sophomore year, you also make your first actual film. So you do like, you shoot 16mm reversal film where the film that's in the camera is what you're actually cutting. You know, you're not making a positive of the negative. You're actually, you know, developing the stuff that's going through the camera and then you're cutting that up and you edit that physically, like on an old Steenbeck with a razor and tape it back together.
Oh, God.
Craziness. Yeah. But a good thing to learn. Well,
appreciation, you know, like.
Yeah, exactly.
So the name of the film is A Convenient Truth. So obviously a play on an existing film.
Yeah.
Why don't you give a little summary of it? And then I got like a whole bunch of things I took from it and questions.
Okay, sure. It is a parody of An Inconvenient Truth, which is the Al Gore movie where he goes around and basically gives his lecture about global warming around the world, really. And so in our film, we follow another politician whose name is Coleman Burleson. He's from California, and he's similarly going around the world, but he's not just pointing out the negatives, the downfalls of global warming. He actually has a solution. It's shot in the documentary style just like that, and basically his solution is to take the undocumented workers that are in his state, California, and hire them to ride bicycles that generate electricity in his factory.
Right.
So it's that kind of like ridiculous conceit, but it's done really, really straight. Like there are no...
Right. It's like almost like the first, I'd say, 15 minutes. I just watched a film yesterday. Dom sent me a site to view it on. I just watched the first 15 minutes. You're kind of wondering what the hell is going on here. Like, now I knew a little bit from your previews, like from over the years. But you know, you're like, what is he talking about? It's almost, you get like a lot of scenes of nature and things that we, and a city and take for granted. And, there's some interviews in the street and then all of a sudden he drops this idea of, you know, powering electricity with illegal Mexicans. And then the tone after that, you kind of get it, you know, going in, it's kind of like that mockumentary style,
right?
The live camera feeling, the shaky cam, like, now, first off, where'd you come up with this? Did you write this yourself or?
I did. I came up with it. So senior year of college, I made it my thesis film in Initial Conditions, and we were sitting around at some point during that, like prepping for that actually. And, you know, just in the dorm room, and we ordered, I think maybe it was around the time that An Inconvenient Truth came out or something. I don't know, but we were talking about the idea and we ordered some food and the guy who delivered it was, you know, Mexican as they often are.
Right.
In New York. And
everywhere, dumb.
Yeah, I guess everywhere. I don't know if it's a more or less racist to say that, but just an observation. And so I kind of just made an offhanded joke, like, why don't we just, he was wearing a bike helmet because that's how they deliver the food. And I was like, they really like.
You see that later on. In the
yeah. And I was like, they really like riding bikes. Why don't we just ask them to ride bikes in that generate electricity and we'll solve all our problems. Just kind of as like an offhanded joke. And then I got really into the idea, started doing research. At one point I was even thinking of like ditching Initial Conditions and making this a short film version of this for my thesis. But it was too far gone.
So what year is this? What year is the inception of this idea?
A long time ago. I would say
like 2006, something like that.
06 or 05 it would have to be. And then it wasn't the first script that I wrote. And after I graduated, I focused on writing. I wrote a different script. Then I wrote this one second. And then I had written actually, I mean, this is years later, I would say like 2008 maybe.
Right.
I had written like four scripts and I was about to start my fifth. And then Charlie Pinto, who's one of the producers, you know, he's always, you know, or we met at film school and we were talking and he called me up and he had read this script, which was originally called A Modest Proposal for the California State Energy Crisis, mm-hmm. or A Convenient Truth.
Right.
And he'd read that and he was like, you know, neither of us believe in writing a low budget script just for the sake of like, maybe we could do it because you're like limit yourself.
Right.
So he kind of called me up though. And he was like, you know, you kind of did write the lowest budget script that you're going to write. Like, even if you did this the way you want it to, it's not going to cost a lot of money and you're not going to write something that's cheaper than this. So why don't we just, instead of you write that next script, why don't we do this?
Do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess that's, so that's the genesis of the idea now.
Yeah.
You original script, how many pages are we talking? Or, you know, how long were we expecting it to be?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it was like maybe 90 either between like 88 and 91 pages.
So in that hour and a half range.
Yeah, I mean, it's from the beginning, I wanted it to be as close to an hour and a half as possible.
Right. So, okay, now the Coleman character, okay, mm-hmm. obviously the star of the show. Mm-hmm. He's got a little, he's got a little of The Office in him, a little Steve Carell in him, I get from him.
Mm-hmm.
That sarcastic, that ability to, like, you know, not crack a smile, be very, you know, very serious. He's obviously, you know, the standout actor in the film. Where'd you get him? And how'd you get him?
Just auditioning. I mean, that's the sort of beauty of New York is that there's no shortage of really, really talented actors. So. Right. You know, you put out casting calls on backstage, et cetera, and, you know, we held auditions at after hours at the place where I worked at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you get hundreds and hundreds of headshots for a non-union, no low pay, you know, like just because people want to be in a movie.
Exactly.
So we got lots of headshots. We did three or four rounds of auditions. we cast him.
Yeah, he's, by the way, he's great. He's fits the role perfectly. Everything up to his, like, terrible hair in the back. was that a wig or was that his actual hair?
It was a wig that we gave. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was awesome. There's another guy in the film that stood out to me. I think it was Leonard.
Yeah, yeah.
I loved him. He was like the
nice.
I don't know. How do you describe him? Like, over-enthusiastic supporter.
Yeah, I mean, well, so the easiest way would be wingman or what's the word that people use on the internet for fanboy? You know, he's sort of like a mix between a wingman and a fanboy. He's actually a lot of the names in the film from the script are like not so subtly, like his name is Leonard Wingman.
Oh, okay.
There's a few other things like that too. So.
I loved him. He plays, you know, he's over enthusiastic. Even like his office that you guys set up with the, I noticed the stuffed bird. Like,
yeah, yeah.
he definitely, you know, adds to it. He gives the, gives a little even more comic relief. Now, okay, so filming, you're about to start. Budgeting. That's the first question here. What are we talking budget wise? How'd we do it?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because there's so many versions of this. Like, when we first did pre-production, the budget came out to, like, $600,000 or so.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and it was, you know, for a long time, we were trying to get investors to meet that goal to do it, to do that, which, like, the main difference was that was a fully union production. And, we couldn't do it, and eventually we just were like, what's the version of this that we can do with money that we have? And it, you know, quickly became non-union, which is unfortunate, but had to be that way.
Right.
And so I think ultimately the budget turned out to be just under $100,000 or something like that.
Wow. That's a significant difference.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's,
where'd a lot of it come from? Just investors or yourself or?
No, I mean, some of it came from, So the three producers on the film, Charlie, I already mentioned, Beth Renfro, who's another person who helped out, and Patrick Stewart, who's the other producer, he has a production company called Reclamation Entertainment. Mm-hmm. And so that, so it's technically a Living Daylights Pictures, which is my production company, and Reclamation Entertainment production, because they gave us, or they invested, I think it was $11,000 or something like that. Mm-hmm. I got another private investor to give 10. And then all the rest was money I had saved. I mean, that was the one good thing about the process, was that it took so long that, and we shot it like a real documentary, that, you know, we had years to save as we were doing stuff, and we would shoot as much as we could and then, you know, cut a trailer or use that to try to keep getting, raising money. And then I'd be saving the whole time. And then the very, very last push was actually, like $19,000 on credit cards.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which you should never, ever do. And we knew we should never, ever do it. But at that point, you're committed. You have, you know,
one shot, right?
Yeah, you got to take a chance on yourself, and you got to, you know, when you have partial film, you have to, you know, you have to finish it. So
right. Now, the start of shooting, what, when were we talking that, like what year were we, did we actually start the film?
I think it was probably 2009.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, it was what it was, like we were going to shoot, like basically the whole thing in, I don't actually remember. It was so long ago, but we were going to shoot a certain amount of days, and then right before we were about to start shooting, we realized we didn't have the money to do all of it.
Right.
So we shot actually like 6 days in 2009, and then edited something out of that. But I mean, all in all, the film we only shot about, I want to say 17 or 18 days, mm-hmm. but that was over like 3 years worth of shooting.
Right. Well, that's a good commitment from everybody, really. You know?
Yeah, no, I mean, we couldn't have done it without the actors and the crew, like really just being available. And, you know, that once you've shot one scene with an actor, if at any point they, you know, God forbid something happened, or they just decide they're not into it anymore, then everything you've done is lost. It's so gone. we, like that, as good as that main actor is, Alan Berman's his name, he was perfect for the role, but he was also so committed that that made it possible.
Right. So you start shooting, obviously you recruited, there's several main actors, or supporting roles. There's the daughters, the wife,
mm-hmm.
the kid who got caught touching himself at McDonald's.
Yeah.
Definitely some cool things. One thing I did notice about the film, there was a, now you, obviously the illusion is that you were going for California.
Yeah.
Now where was it all shot?
Not California.
I gathered that.
Yeah. I mean, the thing was, the film is mostly interiors anyway. So it was actually shot in New Jersey a lot, New York, some in a studio that we built some stuff in Philadelphia.
Really?
But because it's mostly interiors, it didn't really matter too much, you know?
That was like one of the things I was wondering, because the beginning, there's a lot of like stock footage, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
The Golden Gate Bridge and all different things like that. How do you go about getting that? Like, do you have to pay for any of that, or?
Yeah, most of it you have to pay for, but it's, you know, there are cheap versions of it, right? So like the most expensive, though, if you were at like a TV studio or a film studio, they'd be Getty Images, and right. Each one of those is going to be like $1,500, which is ridiculous.
Right.
But there are things like Shutterstock, and actually so one thing I'm doing is that I'm going through the film scene by scene and actually writing a blog article about like the lessons that I learned.
Right. I've read a couple.
Yeah, and
one of them I'm going to bring up in a minute, but
so yeah, but like so, scene two of that is stock footage, and I literally just listed all of the sources of stock footage that we used and with links and everything, just because I think it's a really good resource for people who do want to make films to just know that these are out there, and that you might kill yourself spending a lot of money getting something, and you know it's out. It's only going to work for documentaries or mockumentaries, really. But right. it is out there. So. Right.
And what about the, like the music, the score on the film? There's some music, not a ton.
There's not a ton of music. Some of it is actually from An Inconvenient Truth. So like due to, it's actually Creative Commons license, but more than that, it's because there's something called fair use in law. So it's like when you're directly parodying, it's free speech really, and when you're directly parodying something, they can't stop you from using it.
Okay.
Because for obvious reasons, you know, like if you're going to make some company or some political figure, but you need their permission to do so, then you're not going to be able to do so. So
I that's another thing. That's what I meant to touch on. You had a lot of stock footage of I don't know if it was CNN footage or whatever it was from like politicians and stuff like that. Is that also kind of the same thing or?
Well, some of it is. So like anything on whitehouse.gov is in the public domain.
Oh, nice.
And then there's like C-SPAN, you can just order footage from them. So that was like, you know, you can pay for that and it's relatively cheap.
So like you were, I'm guessing, green screening him in and.
Or... Yeah. Yeah. So all of the stuff where he's in the Congress is, and actually not to keep referencing the site, but there's a whole Vimeo link that shows it, but we basically just shot him standing in front of a podium or behind a podium in front of a green screen.
Right.
And then we composited him in. Yeah, that's how we did that.
Yeah. So probably my favorite part of the film was the his ads, his random commercials that pop up in the middle. Hmm. One of them sticks out. What is a greasy animal or?
Like, oh, yeah. It's this is what a greasy living thing looks like, thanks to BP.
A dog covered in oil or a bird covered in oil.
Right, yeah. It was actually from the BP oil spill. It was, like, footage from all of these, like, animals and stuff that, like, this, like, devastating footage of them covered.
It cuts to a close-up of, like, a Mexican guy's forehead. covered in sweat, and it says something like, "This is one in California."
Yeah, exactly. So that's like the parallel greasy living thing.
Loved it. A couple scenes with bikes, loads of bikes.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, people generating electricity or the illusion of that. Mm-hmm. Did you pay for all these bikes? Or you?
Yeah, we did actually. It was so with renting them. Would have turned out to be more expensive because if we rented real bikes, we would need to also buy like the bike trainer that keeps them stable.
Right.
You know, and then we'd have to rig them. So we actually found these really, really cheap exercise bicycles. And I was just like scouring the internet for places I could find them where they were still in stock. And I bought them for like $100 each.
Wow.
Some of them I even got for 80, depending. And so I wound up buying over 20 of these bicycles.
Yeah, that's what I was, you know, I'm sitting there watching the film and I'm like, oh man, you know, yeah. At one point there's gotta be one, probably around 20 on in a scene, something like that. 15 maybe.
Yeah. I mean, probably, I mean the widest shot, we probably used all of them, which was like 21, 22 bikes, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah,
I was like, that's definitely a part of the budget there, but it definitely is probably, I guess, some of the bigger scenes in the entire film.
Especially
the ending, which we won't give away. But
yeah, but we had to. Thing is, like, you know, the first 10 minutes of the film, like you said, it's someone alluding to this thing, to this thing, to this thing. When you eventually get to the reveal of what it is, that's one reveal. But then there's another reveal where you actually see it happening. And the thing is, like, you can't tease the audience and not pay off on it. So
right. you can't do two bikes in a
yeah.
And
when
have
he walks
guys bobbing that, up and down in the background, and,
exactly.
Like on him.
Exactly. So when he walked into that room, we wanted people to feel like, holy shit, like this is ridiculous, you know.
Now the presentations he's doing in the film,
mm-hmm.
The people in the audience. Did you ever try having him actually presented to unknowing audiences at all, or was it all set up?
No, I mean, so
I would love to see that done.
Well, because of the venues that we were in, which were so huge that we got that were great for production value, like literally like 1,400 seat theaters.
Right.
So we could never actually turn around and show the crowd that we had there because we would never have been able to get enough extras to fill it up.
Yeah.
The closest thing that we did was a lot of the man on the street interviews are totally real.
Good. I was just you took me to my next segment here on my little phone that I have written down. There's definitely, you know, a couple men on the street kind of things. you get some interesting people. Now shooting that, go through the process of that. Obviously, he has to stay in character.
Yeah.
You have any funny experiences with that? Anything? Any people get angry or? Some of your people were definitely like, you know, shot out like. They had no clue what was going on.
Yeah, well, I mean, so one thing I will say is if you're doing this, have somebody dedicated standing by with release forms and right. get people to sign it before they even, you know, if possible, get them to, like, you know, we didn't tell them we were doing a fake movie. We didn't tell them we were doing what the topic was. We just said, hey, we're making a movie. Do you want to be interviewed? And get them to sign a release. And then, you know, the thing was, he was asking questions about relatively general topics, and same with his daughter. Like, we weren't saying – he wasn't walking up to people and saying, hey, I want to put Mexicans on bikes. He would say, like, hey, what do you think about the oil crisis? What do you think about global warming? What do you think – you know, real topics so that we could get sound bites to then slide into our – yeah, no, I guess we didn't mention, but the film was broken up into these, like, five distinct – sections. So we were kind of, we had that in mind, and we were asking people about, you know, what could we ask somebody that might work for this section?
Yeah. You know, definitely the film was nicely paced, a lot of breakup in, you know, between presentation, between him and his house, between man on the street kind of stuff. So you definitely get a good variety of things. I wrote down right here, there's this one, I guess it's stock footage, I hope, anyway, where the guy is yelling that Mexico hit the Twin Towers.
Yeah, that. Well, it's, yeah, I mean, that we didn't, that's
I was laughing a real, so
a
hard.
A real guy, though. I mean, so the there's a guy on YouTube who is Latino, I believe, and he'll go to these rallies and, you know, record stuff. And so that's, it is real, though. Like, it's real. Like, that's the thing, was that a lot of the things, like, anything we could make up would be not as crazy as the reality of it. So.
Yeah. So what I'm explaining is there's, like, a rally going on, and I guess it's like an immigration rally.
Minutemen. They're real people, and it's a Minutemen rally.
Right. And this guy just starts screaming. You know, a couple people are screaming some racist stuff, but then this guy starts screaming, Mexico hit the towers. Mexico hit the towers. And he's exactly what you would picture, you know, white trash. But yeah, that was probably, you know, I was laughing so hard at that. So the film, you start to edit it, you start to put it together. Now, are you involved all the time in the editing? I noticed that it was edited by someone else.
Yeah, I mean,
or you like over the shoulder, or you basically give them what you want. Like, how's that go?
So Charlie Pinto, who's a professional editor and also the one of the producers that I mentioned, he is the editor. I did all of the, you know, because he's doing everything for free. So I did all of the assistant editing work. Like, I loaded everything into Avid. I synced everything up. Like, I put everything into bins. I got everything ready to go.
What was it shot on again before?
Mostly on an HPX 170 that I bought because it was cheaper than having to rent it all the time. But some of it, the first 6 days that when we rented all the equipment, we shot on an XPX, I think 500 or 900, whatever that huge one is.
So all film?
No film.
All digital. No film.
Yeah. I mean, nobody, because it's a documentary style, nobody would be shooting it on film in reality. So,
editing.
So yeah, so I got everything prepared, and then he edited it. I mean, he never edited without me. I was always sitting next to him in the booth.
Nice.
But yeah, he's the editor for sure. I mean, he is.
So how many hours are we talking here? Hundreds?
I honestly could not tell you. I mean, because he is an editor and full time, we would edit on weekends. Mm-hmm. And literally we would be like, you know, we would go there at 11 in the morning and we'd leave at 11 at night, and we would just do that for more weekends than I could count.
Yeah.
So.
Well, so the film is pretty much, you know, done. I'm assuming, is that the final version I watched or close to it?
This is the final version. So the film is currently looking for distribution, but if I have to self-distribute it, So the hope is that we'll get distribution, and that will include some money for music rights, et cetera.
Right.
If I have to self-distribute it, then I'll have to go back through the movie and change a lot of the music because I won't be able to afford the rights.
Right. So we're getting towards, you know, kind of where we are now. The one question I wanted to ask before, what was the biggest challenge? The biggest challenge is that you came your way during this. The worst days, like, getting you to, you know, say fuck this film, or like, were there ever like dark moments where you're like, oh, you know, this isn't gonna get done, or what obstacles were like immovable or seemed immovable at times?
It's hard. I mean, I think that it's weird because I think it's natural, and there were totally times when I probably, if I had let myself, wonder, is this ever going to get done? But I think the only reason it did get done is because I never really fully had that thought. Like, I always knew this was going to get done. It was just going to take a certain amount of time that I didn't know yet. So
no major curveballs that...
I mean, it was literally just the amount of time that it took. I mean, our worst day in terms of production, which is definitely not the worst days overall, because production is the fun part.
The best part, yeah.
But our worst day in production was the day that we were shooting, where we had all the extras and we were shooting the stuff in the lab that we built. And I shouldn't laugh, but we had these guys, you know, we had everybody riding these bikes, and you know, I would say like, all right, we're gonna get the shot, and like pump everybody up and be like, all right, now pedal hard. And after about 15 minutes of doing this, this guy just falls over on the bike, just collapsed. And this was like our busiest day, right? And so I'm sitting there thinking, like, I feel bad for him, but this is gonna fuck up our entire day. So he gets taken to this other room, this little green room. Paramedics come. I mean, he's out cold.
Oh my God.
The guy on the bike next to him, luckily, was there with him and like kind of caught him as he fell. So it was actually really scary for a time. Turned out, we found out he should have never been riding the bike. He had been shot,
what?
He had been shot a few months earlier, or maybe in a few weeks earlier, and was like just released from the hospital and had all these like health problems. Oh my and God. So it's just like terrible. And because, you know, and so I'm sitting there feeling bad for him, but also losing like an hour and a half on the day where we had the most setups and the most shots possible and just so much. So that was rough because I had to kind of on the fly cut a lot of the coverage and say, okay, we absolutely need this. We don't need this, et cetera.
Right. Wow.
And actually,
Mexican.
I think he was Puerto Rican, actually. He was actually a great guy. He actually came back, and speaking of the ads that you mentioned,
right.
there's the not funding terrorism ad anyway, he plays that guy.
Yeah.
So he came back and we kind of dressed him in like traditional garb, and he played that guy. So he was a good, really, really good sport about it. Yeah.
Awesome. Now, you've been writing a blog. I've been checking, you know, here and there. One of them, you talked about acting in the film, and very early in the film, you are basically playing the director.
Yeah.
Not really a far shot.
Yeah.
Putting yourself in your own film, tough or no?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not an actor. I hate performing. The conceit from the beginning was that we were going to have the whole crew play themselves, just because it's easier. If somebody dips into frame, it makes sense. You don't lose the shot. And also, we wanted to market it as a real film as much as possible. That was the original conceit. You know, I was going to, at the premiere, hire Mexicans to pick it and things like that for, you know, as marketing tactics.
Go to Home Depot.
Right. So the idea was like, if somebody ever sees this film and wants to interview me about it, then I can count on myself to keep the joke, sort of, like, you know, not let on that this is fake and just completely sell it as if it's real for as long as possible.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it was not fun to act. I mean, I think
several takes or no?
Oh, yeah.
Nail it.
Yeah, several takes. I mean, six or seven takes probably. Okay. Not all because of me, just because, you know, we had to get the framing right and things like that.
Yeah,
but
right.
But I can definitely say I was the worst actor in the film. So.
I was watching, like, oh, Dom's in it, first thing, you know, like, oh my God, I was expecting, like, multiple appearances.
So,
you're making this movie, you get a lot of friends and family that are, like, I want to be in it, or is it more, like, pulling teeth, like, can you please fill this part or be an extra or something like that?
Or definitely more like pulling teeth. I mean, I do not come from a family or circle of performers, so it was
your dad, he's a performer.
No, he didn't. I think my immediate family, my older brother Frank and my younger brother Chris are in the one of the Minutemen scenes, just kind of sitting in the basement.
You know, it's funny, I read the credits and I was like, oh shit, I got to go back and find them.
They're just kind of sitting in the basement. They're not the two main Minutemen are Scott and then this other guy who we auditioned. So we just needed extra people to fill that room. And then the guy who plays Thomas Corpulent, who loses all the weight because of Burleson, is actually my cousin.
I thought I recognized him from, I know he came to a soccer game once, I remember.
Yeah, he's an actor and he's my cousin, you know, so, and that was another benefit of shooting over such a long period of time was that he actually has lost over 100 pounds.
Wow.
So we shot the first part, you know, with him at that weight, and then the conceit within the movie is that he's lost a lot of, there's an obesity section in the movie, and it's that they're making people lose weight by working in this lab. It's one of the things that it helps, and he had lost over 100 pounds, so I went back, just me, you know, didn't have any lights, didn't have just me and the tripod and the camera, and shot sort of the equivalent of the scene that we already had.
Right.
Just reshot it with him being much, much skinnier, and it works really well for the movie because it looks real, you know. Definitely. Looks like he lost all this weight because he did. So. Yeah.
My fucking dog is going nuts. Do you hear him?
Yeah.
Oh, God. It doesn't matter. That's what podcasting's about. But, okay, so the film is just about finished. I know that you are going film festival route. What's our plans now? What are we doing here?
Right. So, yeah, we had our premiere in January to this. Yeah. So at New Filmmakers New York. So obviously in New York. And then we just screened in April at the Garden State Film Festival. We have a couple of film festivals in California, one in the UK that we're still waiting to hear back from. And so basically our time frame now is, all of that will happen in the next 6 months or so, and we'll push for somebody to hopefully pick us up for distribution.
Yep.
In that time, and then if that doesn't happen, then you know, it's a brave new world. You can distribute yourself,
right?
Any number of ways. So that's what we'll be doing.
So how's that process getting into festival and stuff? Painstaking or not too bad?
It's expensive. It's, right. Each film festival is usually anywhere from, I'd say the average is like 40, 50 bucks. Some are over 100. Some are, you know, you might get lucky and if you apply early, it might be 20 or 30. But we easily spent probably over $1,000 applying to film festivals.
Okay. Well, so, it's worth it. I mean, now it's time to get that film out there.
Yeah, exactly.
Hopefully this podcast helps. But, so you got the film done. It's pretty much done. It's now into the trying to get people to watch it stage. You got to feel like extremely accomplished at this point, but you also have a gigantic road ahead of you.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I've said it a lot recently, but it's like in film school, they tell you make a good film and that's all you have to worry about. And I think that was maybe true when I was in film school and people were buying more movies at festivals and distributors, et cetera. Now it's actually making the job, making the film is half the job and then getting people to actually see your film is the other half.
Right.
So like you said, that's why I started the blog, the livingdailies.org blog, which is just a way to hopefully drive traffic to a site so that people who are interested, you know, will, when the film is available to buy or rent, et cetera, will actually be like, hey, I just read about this film a bunch. It's worth watching, you know.
What's the goal? Theaters, DVD, online, stream? The goal?
Mostly online streaming, you know, like VOD and or like iTunes, et cetera, right. Netflix. You could do a theatrical, but the reality of for small movies like this is that theatricals are kind of loss leaders, which are you use them to get reviews and you use them to just get your name out there, but right. You're probably going to lose money if you're four-walling it, which is if you're renting the theater yourself.
Is it even worth in theater these days? I mean, I feel like movies are out on film within a week, it seems like, to watch.
It's in some cases it is, in some cases it isn't. You know, that's kind of the game. You have to. There's a quad cinema in New York you can rent out for $11,000.
That's it.
well, for the week, which is actually pretty good.
That's not, yeah.
And so then you keep all the money from the tickets. And the thing is, you probably will not make your money back, but that comes with a publicity agent that they help you with, and it comes with reviews, which is the most important thing. So if you in New York, like we screened in New York, but it was a one-off, so they won't review you. But if you screen for a week, then you can actually get reviews from the major press, and that will help, you know, people know about your film. Nice. So that's that. But that's, yeah, that's $11,000. So you have to weigh that against, like, maybe I should use that to, as more traditional, like, marketing or advertising to get people to know about my film online or something like that. So right. It's all so, producer-y stuff that nobody wants to deal with, you know? So
I really liked the film. I thought it was very creative, well done. Editing, right. Like, I come from an editing background. Timing was good. I like how a lot of the scenes bleed into each other. Anything going on in the future? Projects that you're working on or thinking of? Or is this just your baby right now and you're going gung-ho with it?
No, I come from the school that if you want to do something, you should just do it. And I believe in that. And I'm happy that I made the film. But I also think nobody who makes a film this way would ever do it twice. I think there's statistics that, like, 80% of the people who make a feature film don't make a second film, which is unfortunate. But it's not that I don't want to make another film. It's just that I would never make a film without all the funding being in place ahead of time.
Right.
So in the meantime, I've just been writing, which is, you know, primarily what, you know, it's the thing about writing is that exactly how you imagine it is how it comes out. Whereas, like, making a film is a bunch of compromises. And sometimes you collaborate and that comes out much better than you imagined, but there are also a bunch of times that, you know, the reality of the situation is less, so that can get frustrating. So for now, I'm just enjoying getting back into writing, just writing scripts, and yep. Whether that's to sell to someone else or for somebody to come along and say, hey, we like this, we'll give you the money to make it, you know, I'd be happy with either of those. So
awesome, man.
Yeah.
Absolutely proud of you, sticking to the dream. you've been talking about this shit for we're going close to 20 years, 15 years now, you know?
Yeah, it's probably great, actually, yeah.
Yeah. So that brings me to my little closing segment here. I actually picked this because of you, Dom.
Really?
Honored. So every week I do a little segment called Dirtbag of the Week.
Dirtbag of the Week.
And it's exactly what it sounds like. It's, you know, finding a new story and finding a dirtbag. But this, Dom, for you, the dirtbag is actually a company. And it's DiGiorno Pizza.
It's not delivery, it's DiGiorno?
It's DiGiorno.
It's not delivery, it's a dirtbag?
Yeah, yeah. So, apparently, a video came out from a group called Mercy for Animals. So, obviously, an animal activist group. And it came from Weiss Brothers Farm of Greenleaf, Wisconsin, a 2,500 cow farm and a major cheese supplier for Nestle's DiGiorno Pizza, the country's largest frozen pizza distributor. In the video, farmhands are shown kicking, dragging, stabbing, and screaming cows, and screaming curses at ill milk-producing cows. Cows that are too sick to walk are pulled by ropes around the neck or limbs attached to backhoes. Ulcers and infected open wounds appear common. Basically, there's a lot of outrage. Apparently, companies are dropping, a couple companies are dropping DiGiorno from their stores. how do you feel about that, Dom?
That's pretty terrible. I thought you were going to go with Pat Sajak as your dirtbag of the week.
That's a good one, too.
Yeah. But both are, I'd say, equally dirtbaggy. Yeah.
So it says, Nestle is outraged and deeply saddened by the mistreatment of animals shown in this video. We will not accept any cheese made with milk from the Weiss Brothers farm. Mm. You know, it takes a certain kind of person to just, you know, block out what you're doing at your job daily and just, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, they're not going to be treated like kings, but you know, putting down these animals and, like, dragging them with backhoes and infection and ulcers, it's absolutely disgusting.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, you know, I eat meat, so I'm not coming from the most, you know, I'm not coming from a high horse, but, like, just, like, the lack of humanity that goes into, like, how do you turn off your humanity to that extent where you do that and don't question it or think twice about it? I mean, obviously, there's lots of worse things that people do in that case. So,
not only that, how do you, like, you know, it's your first day in the job, you see this, mm-hmm. and you do it for a day, and you go, all right, I can't wait to go back tomorrow. Like,
You know, it's people following orders, you know, it's like all of those, all that psychology of, like, people tell you to do something, so you do it, which is just Nazi like Germany. Terrible. Nazi Germany, or even that Stanford prison experiment thing, you know.
Exactly. With, yeah. You know,
and the other one with the shocking, you know.
Yeah. Guantanamo Bay torture. You know, we can go into a million different things, but
yeah.
So I'm guessing as a true Italian, you don't. There better not be a DiGiorno pizza in your freezer anyway.
No. Never. No. I don't understand why DiGiorno pizza exists. I mean, I don't know. I've never had it, but I also don't. I've never lived in a place that was not walking distance of a pizzeria. Yeah. So I don't know why you need to like literally it's more effort to go to a grocery store to the frozen section to buy a DiGiorno than it is to
sit on your ass and call the pizza shop.
Yeah. Also, that's the thing. Like, I don't get the premise. It's not delivery. It's DiGiorno. But like, delivery is the easiest thing on earth. Like, if you're saying it's
that, it probably takes like a half hour, 40 minutes to heat the thing up.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like usually when you're saying it's not something, it's because that other thing is bad, but it's like nobody had a beef with delivery.
I want to find a guy who has a beef with delivery pizza.
It's like, actually, this is America, and people are probably complaining about not being able to get more things delivered to their front door.
It's funny you say that. Yesterday, the ice cream man came around.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh shit, you know, the ice cream man is still in business. Like, there's no way he is still dominating the market. Like, kids are, half of them aren't outside anymore. Like, it's true. Used to be out on our bikes and outside and be like, oh, he's at the ice cream man.
Yeah.
Like Eddie Murphy, you know, like, the ice cream. Like, I want to revamp the ice cream business. I want to make it like a craft beer / ice cream truck or a drink of the week. So you see, like, dads and moms running to the truck. You know, while playing with their kids outside, get a nice tall boy of a craft beer they never had. Get a little Chipwich or Taco Taco for the kid.
You know? I feel like it's like anything. Well, maybe not from the same band. I like the idea, but I don't like the idea of mixing it with the kids. But I feel like any
bands.
Anything where there's a high enough margin where you can afford to cover the cost of bringing it to someone, like, that's, it's not a bad idea, you know.
Man, like, if that's, like, kept changing it up too, like, oh, something different, like, or homebrewed beer, like, I'd be sprinting out there with gathering change from the couch. And
yeah, well, it was like crack when, like, you know, you're a kid and you hear that thing, like, something just glazes over in your eyes,
like,
and you just go nuts.
Dogs.
Yeah,
you start drooling and running. You don't even know what direction you're running because it's going around the block, but it sounds like it's right next to you.
Well, and the ironic thing is that, like, the natural extension of that is the food truck craze, but the food truck craze is, like, the food trucks just all stay in one place.
Right.
So you have this mobile thing that comes to you to a certain point but doesn't actually
it's
drive
still
around.
Almost like a restaurant.
You know? Yeah, exactly. So, but I love it. I can think of more things that if they drove around and were offered to me, I'd be interested in than not, you know? I'd be like, hey, these people are driving, I don't know, candy bars to me. All right. I don't have to – I'll take it.
You could open your own food truck called Wet and Slow.
You should watch that. I think you'd enjoy it. It's like 10 minutes. It's got it's actually, now that I think about it, I've never actually thought about this, but it's actually like the closest predecessor to A Convenient Truth because it's, you know, it was the documentary class, but it's like half documentary, half mockumentary because I had like my brother interviewing him and he clearly was like making, you know, he wasn't being totally natural and stuff. So
awesome.
Yeah.
All right. So again, this is a Verbal Shenanigans podcast. I just found out that I've been telling you to get on Stitcher. I actually just got approved by Stitcher, so the podcast should be up on there. Again, you could subscribe through iTunes. You could have it right on your phone. You could stream it from Podbean. A lot of different options, trying to work on different ways to get it. Might start putting it on YouTube. Working on getting it out there. But Dom, you have any websites you want to plug or anything like that?
Just livingdaylights.org, which is the website for the film. I mean, it's the website for the production company, but it's almost 100% about the film at this point. So if anybody's interested, check it out.
Awesome. Thanks for coming on. I wish you the best of luck.
Cool.
I'm sure it'll be good.
I look forward to listening more to this because I enjoy it. So
absolutely. We'll have you back on when maybe when you get some distribution.
Yeah.
Give us an update.
Happy
and then
day.
We could also talk about like growing up Italian.
Yeah, for sure.
World Cup coming up.
I'm really pumped. I got the USA games and the Italy games in my calendar.
Absolutely.
So, playing around them.
Yeah, I just talked about that on the last podcast. How people
I know.
Not even born in the country, rooting for, like, you know, They don't even watch the U.S. They're like, oh, fuck the U.S.
I'm like, I think it's fine. I think it's fine as long as you're rooting for both, you know? And I also didn't fall into that category because I am kind of the dual citizen. You know, both my parents, both my parents are born in Italy, so I have the... I have, in terms of DNA, I'm entirely
in trouble. We're in trouble.
It's a tough group.
You got this whole Portugal pulled that joke because they're known to do it, but...
I can say right now that Germany is going through.
Yes.
The only way that I see it happening for the U.S.
You got to be Ghana, straight up.
Well, no. I literally think it might be like this crazy Thai thing, where like
they can pull Thai off Germany or something.
Maybe like they pull off some sort of ties, and then the other like Ghana and Portugal tie as well, but then Or, I don't know, some version of tie and losing, you know, like Germany wins out, so neither of those people get
a point. Any
get a point at all. And then maybe, or maybe everybody ties each other and it goes to some other crazy goal differential or whatever it goes to.
Fingers crossed. I'm nervous. You know, the whole team's new. It's like you got a couple guys that I'm not even crazy about.
Well, the thing is, like, they're not – I feel like they're also not doing their job in the media. Like, I was watching a Red Bull game, and, like, you should be able to say your opinions or whatever. Uh-huh. But the announcers are just like, yeah, I'm not too happy about these 30 guys. And, it's almost like they're telling people not even to bother watching. It's like they still have to play the game, you know. Like, let's, you know, get people pumped up about it.
Draws especially happen all the time, you know. Like, I'm not looking for an upset, but you can pull a draw out occasionally.
And Portugal usually – defense. Portugal usually has a really good D, but it's not they don't score that many goals usually.
Yep.
Like, so they specifically, I think, are a team where you could see like a 0-0 tie happen pretty easily. So we'll see. But I mean, you got to watch it. There are also teams that, like, you know, just it's the World Cup. People, you know, you could have no affiliation to some country and all of a sudden like get super psyched about, you know,
I got Belgium,
South Korea or Chile.
I got Belgium as my sleeper. That roster is stacked.
Good luck with that. No, I actually like watching South Korea a lot. I think they're fun to watch, and they always like sneak through.
Korea, what the fuck?
Yeah, they're fun to watch, dude. They have been in the past. I know nothing about them this year.
Yep.
I assume they're in it even. I don't even know that for sure. But
They're in it.
But the other
Korea can't participate.
they're usually really fast and like totally they're always so fit. So and they actually have skill. So, you know,
all right, you heard it here first from the Italian picking South Korea.
No, I'm picking Italy.
Yeah. Your dad's crying behind you right now. All right. Tune in next week. This should be up shortly. Keep the wind at your back. Love ya.